Welcome to SCOTUscast, Healthcare and the Individual Mandate Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On March 26 and 27, 2012, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in the United States Department of Health and Human Services versus Florida, which is one of the three cases before the court involving the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act of 2010, sometimes referred to as Obamacare or the Health Care Act. This case presents the question whether Congress has the power under the Constitution to require that virtually all Americans either obtain health insurance or pay a penalty. This requirement is commonly referred to as the individual mandate. This case also raises the question whether the Anti-Injunction Act prohibits a challenge to the validity of the Health Care Act until the individual mandate takes effect in 2014. This question will be the subject of a separate podcast. To discuss the individual mandate, we have Ilya Soman, who is an associate professor at the George Mason University School of Law, and Oren Kerr, who is professor of law at the George Washington University Law School. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. And now, Professor Kerr.
So the Supreme Court just held 3 days of fascinating oral argument on the healthcare cases. And to my mind, the results were pretty surprising. We're seeing probably 4, if not 5, justices basically echoing the basic framing of the case from the challengers to the individual mandate. In my view, it's not a position that really is based on Supreme Court precedent, and I think it's in tension with the presumption of constitutionality, which traditionally has applied to federal statutes. But certainly the justices, the Republican-appointed justices, were echoing the basic approach, the sort of framework that has been offered by the challengers to the individual mandate, which is that, you know, the key question should be whether the individual mandate is something totally different from what we've ever seen before. And the thought is that if it's very different from what we've seen before, that essentially frees the justices from the very broad Commerce Clause precedents that we've seen in the past, and they no longer apply. We're in kind of a new category, and then the job should be to craft kind of a new framework of constitutional law for this new kind of thing called mandates rather than more traditional regulations of prior activity. It sounded like there's a majority of justices that agree with that framing. The really interesting question is, what are they going to do once they agree with that framework? It looks like the key vote is going to be that of Justice Kennedy, and he suggested during the oral argument on the mandate that he was likely to think that maybe there's some sort of heavy burden of justification on mandates, perhaps the thinking being that instead of the usual rational basis review in Commerce Clause precedents, maybe there's heightened scrutiny to ensure that the mandate is proper in this particular case. And then, of course, that requires the court to kind of craft a framework for whether the individual mandate in this case satisfies whatever test the court creates for this sort of heightened scrutiny of a mandate. So it's really not clear to me which side is going to ultimately win. It sounds like it's kind of, you know, could be 50-50. We don't really know. At the same time, assuming Justice Kennedy's vote is the controlling vote, and assuming what he said at the oral argument ends up being his view, whether or not the court upholds the individual mandate, you know, it's not so significant actually from the standpoint of the overall course of constitutional law, because what you'd end up with under the framework that he suggested is that some sort of special justification is required whenever Congress wants to enact a mandate. That would discourage the creation of the mandate. It would encourage Congress to, if they wanted to enact a new entitlement program, do so directly under the taxing power and basically stay away from mandates. I suspect where we'll go, regardless of whether the court upholds this particular law or strikes down this particular law, in a direction of saying mandates are a special category, you have to justify them in a special way, and that will discourage Congress from enacting another mandate.
And now, Professor Soman.
I think Oren and I disagree about what the outcome of this case should be, but I think there's a lot of common ground between us over what happened in the oral argument. Essentially, what happened in the oral argument, I think, is this. The conservative justices zeroed in on what I think has always been the biggest weakness in the government's case here, which is that all of the different rationales that they've offered for the individual mandate, if they were to be accepted for the court, would be essentially a blank check to impose pretty much any other kind of mandate that Congress could think of, whether it be the so-called broccoli mandate, a car purchase mandate, and so on and so forth. And that is anathema to anybody who believes that there are serious limits on congressional authority in the Constitution, and also to, of course, to anyone who believes, as Justice Kennedy has repeatedly emphasized, that limits on federal power are there not just to protect states' rights, but also the freedom of the individual, as Kennedy wrote in an opinion for the court just last year. So all of the conservative justices in their different ways, all the ones who talked, except for Clarence Thomas, of course, who never speaks, they raised this concern, and they weren't very satisfied, it seemed to me, with the Solicitor General's claims that this is somehow a special case. It's different from other kinds of mandates in different ways. I think also an interesting development in the oral argument was that many people, including, by the way, Orrin and myself, beforehand had felt that the federal government's strongest argument was that the mandate might be justified under the Necessary and Proper Clause, which gives Congress the authority to enact any measures that might be necessary and proper for executing its other powers. And the Supreme Court has in the past defined the word necessary very broadly. However, as Justice Scalia pointed out in the oral argument, Necessary and Proper Clause really includes two separate requirements, necessary and proper. And he further noted that a law cannot be proper if the rationale for it would give Congress virtually unlimited power, as the federal government's rationale, in fact, does. In this case, it seems to me unlikely that the mandate will be able to easily slide by under the necessary and proper argument. Now, that said, during the oral argument, while Justice Kennedy expressed a lot of skepticism about the federal government's position, he also, at different points, seemed to leave open the possibility that he might ultimately endorse one of the federal government's many different possible claims that this is a special case. So whether he will eventually do that or not, I simply do not know. It's very hard to predict, but there's a good chance it will come down to his thinking on that. Finally, in terms of implications for future cases, I agree with Orrin that if the Supreme Court does strike down the mandate, it will be based on a reasoning that applies to mandates but not other kinds of regulations. However, I think this actually is important going forward because there's a large number of industries out there that would be very happy to lobby for mandates, tiring people to buy their product. I'm not saying every single one of those industries would be successful. If the court upholds the mandate, perhaps only a small percentage would be, but a small percentage of all the industries that would want such mandates could still be a significant absolute number of mandates. So cutting off this path towards further expansion of unconstitutional federal power, I think, would be an important achievement, even though, of course, Congress would have lots of other means of regulation, lots of ways to impose taxes on people, and so forth.
And now, Professor Kerr's response to Professor Selman.
I think an underlying question here that's quite interesting is what regulations of mandates, what kind of limits on mandates would be needed to limit congressional use of mandates? Because a lot of the concern here animating the four speaking conservative justices is if you allow a mandate here, does that then lead to Congress enacting lots of mandates? And Ilya suggested that there could, in fact, be lots of mandates in the future. I tend to think, actually, that the reason why mandates have not been enacted is that they're terrible politics. Intuitively, people get the idea of, sure, once you're acting, you can regulate them, but making them act is something that seems pretty offensive. And I think the only reason we had a mandate in this case is that it was considered the more market-based alternative to the single-payer approach. So it was sort of politically aligned as the more centrist approach than the more liberal single-payer approach. So it was sort of peculiar politics of this one case, and ironically, the thought that this would be a more market-oriented approach that might get some Republican votes and be considered more centrist that led to this mandate. I tend to think it's unlikely, even if the court says mandates are the same as regulations of ongoing conduct, I don't think it would probably lead to a lot of mandates in the future. And we see this in the polling on the individual mandate. The mandate polls terribly. People just don't like the idea of being forced to do things. And so the easier way, if Congress is trying to achieve the same regulatory goal would be just to raise taxes and make it an entitlement, which is certainly not popular, but it's a lot easier and I think avoids that strong, intuitive sort of negative reaction that a lot of people have. And I also thought on the question Ilya mentions of whether the proper limitation, the necessary and proper clause, should be interpreted as both Ilya has argued extensively and Justice Scalia offered at oral argument. It's an interesting, novel, new theory of what the necessary and proper clause should mean. I've never seen it in any of the cases interpreting the necessary and proper clause, and Ilya and I have both blogged a lot about this, and Ilya, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I interpret your approach to be that the cases say they're interpreting the necessary and proper clause have really been about the necessary component, and therefore there's just not a lot of cases on what proper means. I've tended to look at those cases and say those are cases on the necessary and proper clause together, and they are talking about what's proper, and therefore this would be a new limitation. But which either way the court approaches it, I think there's a question of what the precedents say, and there's the question of what the court might do. I tend to think that if the court strikes down the mandate, it would be a significant turn from the gist of the prior precedents, but the court, of course, may do it anyway. It's not like the court is confined by a very close reading of Wickard versus Filburn. The Supreme Court often does engage in sort of the creation and articulation of new principles that the justices feel are consistent with constitutional norms. Generally speaking, when it's the liberal justices doing it, the conservatives are quite upset. When it's the conservatives doing it, conservatives tend to think that's great. So there's a lot of room for cynicism in political reaction to the same basic maneuver by justices on the left and right when they're articulating kind of new constitutional principles to enforce prior kind of constitutional norms based on either the text or some broader sort of sense of the spirit of the Constitution. But whatever the source, I think it's likely that or at least 50-50 chance that the court is going to strike down the individual mandate, may strike down more than the individual mandate, might strike down lots of the Affordable Care Act, and we're just going to have to wait and see. Nothing would surprise me at this point. It's pretty open as to what the justices might do.
And now, Professor Sundman will conclude the podcast.
So just 3 points in brief response. First, regarding necessary and proper, it is simply not true that there are no precedents which say there are these two separate standards. At the very least, Justice Scalia himself in the Prince decision that he wrote in 1997 very clearly said that these are two separate things, and he noted that as precedent in the oral argument today. It's possible that he doesn't understand what he himself wrote in that case, but I think it's more reasonable to say that he does, and that if you read that opinion, it doesn't leave a lot of room for doubt that these are two separate things, though I admit, and I think probably Scalia would admit too, that that case by no means fully explains or even come close to fully explaining what proper means. The brief that I filed in the court for the Washington Legal Foundation, I also pointed out that there is language as far back as McCulloch versus Maryland, which I think is best interpreted as an explication of proper, at least to some degree, rather than necessary, though in McCulloch, this is not as clear as one would wish. In terms of the mandate and whether or not mandates would be attractive to Congress, I think a lot of mandates would not be. However, there is many, many different industries out there that would love to lobby for mandates. So if even a small percentage of them were political winners, that could mean a significant absolute number of mandates. Moreover, the possible reason for enacting the mandate that Oren says motivated Congress in this instance is not unique to this case. In almost every other case, you can also argue that enacting a mandate is, quote, a more market-oriented option than enacting a full Social Security-like tax scheme. And I would note also that at a time when taxes are high and additional new taxes are not very popular, Congress in many instances could find that enacting a mandate is a politically easier way to go, especially in cases where it's not part of a big, massive program, which is very politically charged, and as a result, the mandate would not get as much political attention and public scrutiny as this one did. I would further note that it's not the case, I think, that this mandate is there just to pick up Republican votes, because they kept it into bill long after it was pretty clear that virtually no Republicans were going to vote for it. Finally, in terms of the precedent, Oren and I have debated the precedent many times. I think one thing that is clear from in court oral arguments and also from numerous lower court decisions is that the prior precedent was at the very least unclear. Even the decisions upholding the mandate in the lower courts, they did not simply say, well, you know, this is clearly obvious under existing precedents, and here's my quick one or two paragraph explanation. They went on for pages and pages closely parsing the text of the precedent. When you see opinions like that, that's a sign that, in fact, the precedent is uncertain and unclear, and that the court has not actually ruled on a case analogous to this one before. Now, the precedent is unclear. That doesn't necessarily mean that the precedent doesn't support one side more than the other, but it does mean that this is not an easy case under the precedent in the way that many people claimed it was in advance. It's worth noting that in the oral argument, the precedent actually didn't play that much role in much of the discussion, even the discussion by the more liberal justices sympathetic to the mandate. Even they, for the most part, did not press very much the idea that this is simple and easy under existing precedent.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.